Thank you, Cole and Mr. President, Your Excellencies, to those who share the dais with me, to all the members of this university, to both the president of the university in his absence, and to all of you who are here. I greet you with joy tonight. It is an honor and a privilege to stand before you. I bring you greetings, certainly from Washington, D.C. What an honor it is to work in this historic administration, serving with Secretary Hillary Clinton and President Obama. And so it is just good to be here. It's so good also to share once again with Katrina Lantos-Sweat. We have really been around the world together now in the last few days. And so it's good to be here. This is my suit, and I knew I carried mine because I knew I couldn't fit in your son. So it was good to be here. And to all those who have afforded me hospitality, thank you so much for this opportunity to be here. What a wonderful opportunity to be in worship this morning in Salt Lake City and to know that we are instruments in the hands of God. And we certainly send our condolences to the families of Chris Stevens and to the other brave Americans who gave their lives in Libya and to all the Americans who give their lives around the world. And so if you just join me in a moment of silence in their honor and for their memory, I would certainly appreciate it. Amen. Your history and our history, so many of us come from all over the globe. Many of us have in our historical memory persecution. My own faith tradition grew out of the black church not being able to worship as we pleased. And so we understand in our constitution we have, you know, the right to worship as we please. But I go all over the world and I see many who don't. And so the recent instances of violence and protest and unrest throughout the world have emphasized, among other things, the critical importance of what we're now calling 1.5 track engagement. Our efforts to counteract violence are only strengthened, we find, when governments and civil society work in partnership together to gather and to share information quickly and coordinate thoughtful messages that condemn hatred and violence and encourage peace and mutual respect. The Obama administration understands that it's important for us to partner with civil society as well as with government to help religious freedom and democracy flourish around the globe. And so it's been, responses from civil society have been overwhelming and very heartening, and we greatly appreciate all the work that they've done. Just this past Friday, after coming back from Poland, I entertained a group, what we call the Working Group on Religion and Foreign Policy, as we work together, government sitting with civil society. And so as we reflect on the events of the last week, you know, there have been Secretary Clinton and President Obama have made statements, and there have been a range of foreign heads of state, religious leaders, and non-governmental actors who've made two points very clear. One, that there is absolutely no justification for the violence that took the lives of our ambassador and his colleagues and threatened the security of our personnel at diplomatic missions around the Muslim world. But also, too, that the United States government and the American people are deeply committed to religious tolerance and diversity, and that we view free speech and expression as fundamental freedoms that only serve to bolster that commitment. My role as ambassador at large was created in 1998, as Cole said in his introduction, and I am the primary and principal advisor to the President of the United States and the Secretary of State. It was created in 1998. By Congress, along with the United States Commission on International Religious Freedom, which Katrina will share with you about. And so my portfolio is the globe, all 199 countries of this world. And while our country's history of religious freedom dates back to our founding, these principles are not exclusively an American idea or commitment. The international community came together in 1948 to unanimously adopt what is known as the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, or UNDR. Article 18 of which enshrines the freedom of thought, conscience, and religion. And it's on this basis that the U.S. government seeks to advance religious freedom around the world. So Article 18 is the standard against which the U.S. Department of State assesses religious freedom in these 199 countries. And so as Ambassador at Large, we make sure that these countries, I monitor and I also promote religious freedom all around the world. And so what we're calling what is now known as Track 1.5 Diplomacy is a strategic dialogue with faith-based civil society that the Secretary initiated a year ago for peace and prosperity. And while I was at the United Nations General Assembly week before last, we had a civil society-led track that allowed us to have an event co-sponsored by the United States, the Organization of Islamic Cooperation, Religions for Peace International, and the Institute for Global Engagement. And during this meeting, there were three of us who co-chaired the Working Group on Religion and Foreign Policy: myself, Joshua Dubois from the White House Office of Faith-Based Initiatives, and Undersecretary Maria Otero. And at this particular group, Undersecretary Maria Otero delivered a keynote address, and state and civil society leaders were given the opportunity to share best practices for religious engagement. And they discussed potential opportunities for future collaboration, including on such issues as advancing domestic well-being, conflict prevention and resolution, fostering international development, and promoting a culture of human rights. And so many of you know Chris Seipel from the Institute of Global Engagement and Bill Vinley from the Religions for Peace, and we co-chair together what is called FACA, the Federal Advisory Committee. And they've helped to elevate the issue of religious freedom, not just at the United Nations General Assembly, but through the work civil society does each day. And so I must say that the level of attention and interest in religious freedom this year was unprecedented. In addition to this 1.5-track diplomacy event, I delivered interventions at several key meetings, including a high-level discussion hosted by the foreign ministers of Canada, the Netherlands, and Senegal on freedom of religion or belief as an individual's choice. I must tell you that it was standing room only at each of these events. And immediately following the UN General Assembly, I traveled to Warsaw, Poland, with my colleague Katrina for the 16th Annual Human Dimension Implementation Meeting, or called HDIM, of the Organization of Security and Cooperation in Europe. And this in Europe is their largest annual human rights and democracy conference, organized each year by the OSCE Office for Democratic Institutions and Human Rights as a platform for OSCE participating states, partners for cooperation, civil society, international organization, and OSCE bodies. And we emphasize the importance of religious freedom for building stable and secure communities, and we cited key research that shows social hostilities against groups are high when governments restrict religious freedom. This year was special, and Katrina will share more with you, because we were able to share together for the first time in the history of OSCE, which was an important statement and an important optic to see that we do stand as one. Even though our two organizations have different, our two roles have different functions, we stand as one United States government. In July, we released what is known as the International Religious Freedom Report, or the IRF Report, on July 30th, which assesses the events of 2011, a year that brought both new opportunities and enormous challenges. Despite some progress, the overall state of religious freedom in the world is really sliding backward. We saw people reaching for dignity and freedom and demanding that their governments institutionalize democratic reform. However, members of faith communities around the world that have long been under pressure report that that pressure is growing. There are more than 70 countries in 2011 that reported significant acts of anti-Semitism, including violence towards individual Jews or Jewish communities, and the frequency of such acts is increasing worldwide. There are situations in Pakistan that also have great tension. In 2011, the governor of Punjab, Salman Taseer, and the Minister of Minority Affairs, Shahbaz Bhatti, were assassinated for criticizing Pakistan's blasphemy laws. And right now, even as we speak, a young woman, 13 years old, Rimsa, has been released on bail, but there are charges against her for blasphemy. Similarly, in Egypt in 2011, there was sectarian violence at the hands of both government and the perpetrators of crimes. Many countries, including the former Soviet republics of Central Asia, restrict religious freedom allegedly to ensure public safety and counter violent extremism. And those arrested on charges of extremism, including devout Muslims with no apparent ties to violent extremism, are often subject to torture, beatings, and harsh prison sentences. In a number of countries, individuals continue to face harassment and arrest simply for what they believe. In Iran, the government continues to detain more than 100 Baha'i, including the 7 Baha'i leaders who were convicted of espionage for Israel, insulting religious sanctities and propaganda against the system. Many of you may be familiar with the name Pastor Youssef Nadakhani, who spent nearly 3 years jailed under the threat of execution for following his Christian faith. New technologies have given repressive governments additional tools for cracking down on religious expression, as evidenced by the 2012 case of a young Saudi Muslim, Hamza Khashoggi, who was arrested for questioning his faith on Twitter and who now still remains in jail without charge. These are just some of the examples, and they demonstrate what Deputy National Security Advisor Dennis McDonald's recent observation said, that a lack of religious freedom weakens social cohesion and alienates citizens from their government, fomenting internal unrest, breeding extremism, and inhibiting national unity and progress. So in many places around the world today, those who do not think or believe as their governments demand find themselves in a precarious position. But the report is not just glum, and the assessment is not just glum. Progress can be incremental and subtle, while violations of religious freedom are often sudden and dramatic, capturing the attention of the world. We're seeing steps in Nigeria and other places around the world that is making progress. So together with governments, international organizations, and civil society, this administration has also worked to pass and implement what's known as the UN Human Rights Council Resolution 1618, which outlines constructive actions to combat religious tolerance. And it calls upon states to employ practical government and civil society approaches to protect citizens and their right to free expression while promoting respect for religious differences. This past December 2011, we were able to host the first experts meeting to discuss implementation of Resolution 1618, and we focused on sharing best practices. And we're hoping later this year that other countries will pick that up so that the implementation effort can happen. When appropriate, we use other tools. With Iran, we've imposed financial sanctions and travel bans on high-level Iranian officials and entities, including Iran's intelligence ministry. So in addition to diplomatic and policy approaches, the government uses various types of programming to advance religious freedom. We're in the Bureau of Democracy, Human Rights, and Labor, and we currently manage approximately $10 million of foreign assistance funds that, among other things, provide conflict mitigation training to local civil society organizations. It's important for us to partner with civil society as well as with governments to help religious freedom and democracy flourish around the world. We're using the strategic dialogue that I shared with you. But finally, let me share these words about events that happened over the past month that deeply impacted those of us who are part of the State Department family. As we opened with that prayer, we sincerely mourn the loss of the 4 brave Americans who laid down their lives for the United States. They were working with the people of Libya to build a better future for their country. And we also saw diplomatic missions in countries around the Muslim world attacked in reaction to the release of a film made in the United States which insults the Prophet Muhammad. As President Obama recently said at the United Nations General Assembly, which we all just left, Americans have fought and died around the globe to protect the right of all people to express their views, even views that we profoundly disagree with. We do so not because we support hateful speech, but because efforts to restrict speech can quickly become a tool to silence critics and oppress minorities. No matter how offensive the speech, it never justifies violence, like the violence aimed at our facilities and personnel overseas during the past few weeks. All of us, whether we serve in government, civil society, or as religious leaders, must stand up and speak out against violence. It is our responsibility to combat hateful speech while upholding the fundamental freedom to free expression. And as Secretary Clinton said recently, no words, no matter how inflammatory or disgusting, are stronger than the faith that we have. And we should protect our cherished beliefs by standing for them in the marketplace and in the arena of free speech and ideas. Cole shared with you that I was Martin Luther King's goddaughter, Coretta Scott King's goddaughter. In a lot of his writings, he talked about this peace we are looking for. He said, hate cannot drive out hate. Only love can do that. Darkness cannot drive out darkness. Only light can do that. May we be the ones who keep the light alive. Thank you so much.